Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today James Lee Burke. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Vic. It's nice to be on your show again.
Jim, I look forward to the summers because you quite frequently have a new book, and you've got a new one coming out. It's called Light of the World, and this is your 20th Dave Robichaux novel.
That's correct.
Jim, Dave seems to have gotten pretty attached to his vacations in Montana. This one is set in Montana again.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
And you have pretty much made your home in Montana for a number of years now, and it seems that you've really fallen in love with that state.
Well, it's a love affair. That's well put. John Steinbeck said that. Montana's not a state, it's a love affair. But we lived, of course, many years both in Louisiana and Montana, but in the last couple of years, we've spent most of our time here in West Montana.
We probably have one or two listeners out there who have never heard of Dave Robichaux. Could you tell them who this guy is?
Well, he's a sheriff's detective, a homicide investigator for the Iberia Parish Sheriff's Department. And he's on summer vacation up here in Montana with his friend Cleet Purcell and his daughter Alifair Robichaux. And Cleet's daughter, whose name is Gretchen Horowitz, and she's one of my favorite characters.
And Gretchen just surfaced very recently in another book. Do you want to say anything about what she was doing?
Yes, we meet her in the previous novel. Actually, this novel is almost a sequel to Creole Belle. And Cleet discovers that he has had a daughter out of wedlock who grew up on her own in Miami and who became an assassin for the mafia. And it's a terrible discovery for him to learn that his neglect contributed to this girl's terrible life and the evil deeds that she did. But Gretchen turns out to be an extraordinary person. I think she's one of the strongest characters in the Robichaux series.
And in this new book, Light of the World, you give us some aspects of Gretchen's past that give us a little better idea of why she got into that particular line of work.
Well, she was raped when she was 6 years old, and she grew up with a terrible rage and a sense of loneliness and betrayal. And she got even, by working for the mob. And the guy she shot had it coming.
Yeah. James Lee Burke joins us. His new book is Light of the World. They are visiting an old friend in Montana, and this guy's an interesting fellow.
Oh, yeah. He's a retired English professor and writer, a novelist. He's originally from Texas, but he and Dave knew each other when they were both in college at University of Southwestern Louisiana there in Lafayette, and which I was, you know, was my alma mater. But his name is Albert Hollister, and he's a curmudgeon. He was a friend of Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston. He was a wobbly. He did 6 months on a road gang in Florida when he was a kid. But he's a great guy, and he's kind of, like some elderly people I know, and I include myself among them, uneducable.
Yeah.
Totally lacking in wisdom and unteachable on top of it.
He's also a little bit unpopular with some of his neighbors.
Albert really knows how to stir things up. Dave wonders how Albert survived his academic career without his colleagues throttling him.
The book is Light of the World. James Lee Burke joins us on the program. Let's set the stage. As the story begins, Allifair is out exercising.
Yes, in the first chapter, Allifair Robichaud, Dave's daughter, who's also a novelist, and you know, our daughter is Allifair Burke, who's also a novelist, and the both of them, Dave's daughter and mine, graduated at the top of Stanford Law School. That's right. People always say, boy, your wife must really be intelligent, Jim. But anyway, Allifair Robichaud's jogging along the ridge behind Albert's house, you know, west of Missoula. And an arrow flies out of the gloom. It's sunset and embeds in a tree right by her head. Mm. And the only person around is this rodeo cowboy down below. He's fixing a tire on his truck. And his name is Wyatt Dixon. Wyatt is the best villain I have ever written about. He is an extraordinary guy. We meet him in the Billy Bob Holland books. But here, he shows up in the midst of Light of the World. And Wyatt is an antithetical mix. He was sent to Deer Lodge Penitentiary, and they couldn't handle him. They sent him through electroshock and fried his head and made him drink these chemical cocktails, and he became reborn. He speaks Aramaic. Uh-huh. He goes into trances, but he's a remarkable man. Even though he's led a violent life, he has many virtues. He's without fear, and he's a marvelous rodeo performer. And if you've been around rodeo people, you know these are the bravest people on earth, the men and the women both. They are absolutely without fear. I mean, hockey players are pretty rough guys, but nobody makes the cut when it comes to being a rodeo man. Those guys are just, I don't know, I have enormous admiration for them. But Dave Robichaud and Allifair conclude that Wyatt is the guy who fired this arrow. And, of course, it's not he. It was shot by a guy named Asa Surrett, who escaped from a Kansas prison, a truly evil human being. If he's, in fact, human, we're not sure.
And, Jim, I think the last couple of times I interviewed you, and in fact the last time I interviewed your daughter, Allifair, I brought up the fact that when your family was living in Wichita back in the day, I think you were teaching college, Allifair was a little girl.
Yeah.
There was a serial killer in Kansas, and then we start reading this book, and I just said, oh, my. Oh, my. Here we have the serial killer from Kansas. Not the same one, but obviously something that's had a powerful impact on you being in Kansas at the time this guy was operating.
Well, the book goes into the pathology of this kind of person. And I use the word person because a man like this, any of them, what's his name, Bundy, the Green River Killer. Oh, my heavens, my mind goes blank. the Hillside Stranglers. Hmm. There is no explanation for them. That's it. And the first person to tell us that would be a psychiatrist. The origins of their iniquity are not environmental, evidently. I mean, people go through terrible childhoods and turn out okay, or they become marginal criminals. Is it genetic? We're not sure. Or is it possible that some people are born morally insane? Or is there even a darker possibility? There are those who have connections with genuine evil. I don't know. No one does. There's one fact I'm sure of when it comes to men like these. If a person has ever had contact with them and knows of their deeds, what they actually did, the only way you handle it is to push it out of your mind because otherwise they'll take residence inside you. There's no way to deal with the kind of evil they represent. And there's another troublesome fact about these guys. They never give up their secrets. Mm. The only other group I know like them are what are called traiteurs. In Louisiana, they're conjurers. They possess magic. They supposedly cure burns, and it's mojo that comes from the West Indies. Mm. Maybe hokum, I don't know. But they all tell the same story. They say that they get their power from a member of the opposite sex. A man can pass it on to a woman. A woman can pass it on to a man, but only at the time of the conjurer's death. And then if you press them on the subject, they become irate, very defensive, hostile. Serial killers, predators are the same way. They never tell anyone why they did it. Never. They make up lies that'll serve their agenda. Bundy did that. There was a minister, I think, in Florida. He was a good fellow. He belonged to a fundamentalist church, and he was always crusading about pornography. I don't mean that in a derogatory way. He was a man that believed this was very bad stuff, which indeed it is. And so Bundy told him stories about the effects of pornography on his own life. And of course, his ministers listened to him because it seemed to make sense. But I don't believe it. I don't think pornography had anything to do with Bundy. He went to his death refusing to give up the whereabouts of some of his victims' bodies. And they all do that.
Yeah.
And why? There's one answer, maybe. They want to continue to inflict pain on others after they're gone. There was a guy here in Missoula, or in this area, how long has it been? 15 years ago, I guess. He was a kid. He was 21. He broke into a ranch house north of here, and he murdered the husband and wife. And the details are horrible. He's a kid from North Carolina, a drifter. While he was on death row at Deer Lodge Pen, there was a riot. He either killed or participated in the killing of 5 inmates during the riot. Mm. When he was put to death, he slept all day, the day of his execution.
No guilt.
God only knows. He was asked. Once by a reporter, right before this fellow was executed, the reporter said, "Where do you think you're going to go after you're dead, Terry?" And he said, "I will move on to another plane of existence."
Hmm. Yeah. James Lee Burke joins us. Aza Surrett is another one of these incredibly horrible villains that you've imagined here in the last few years. They keep getting more and more ominous and more wicked. You had one in the last couple Hackberry Holland novels who you referred to as the preacher. And here we've got Aza, who likes to masquerade as a preacher. I find this intriguing.
Well, he claims to be a minister, of course. But he takes the name of Geta, G-E-T-A, and also the persona. Geta was the brother of Caracalla, the Roman emperor. Mm. And the two of them ruled the Roman Empire in the early 3rd century A.D. And for Geta's entertainment, his minions put to death two women, Felicity and Perpetua. They're two early Christian martyrs. And I use that story in the book. The book is ultimately about these women. In a strange way, this book travels 1,800 years into the past. Mm. But it's also about the earth. And it's about the importance of women in Christianity. and it's about the importance of saving the earth, and it's about the importance, I think, of telling the truth about the times in which we live. Because I believe the times in which we live, beginning with the Great Depression and up through into this century, will be considered probably the most important era in the history of the species. This is the era in which we'll make the decision to either start doing things differently or we're not going to make it. That's my feeling. The Earth is at risk, and we're in this denial about it. Of course, we meet this tycoon, this guy named Love Younger, who's also a bad guy, but he's a legal bad guy who's doing lots of damage in the world, but he has millions of supporters. While he's sticking it to them, they think he's a great guy, one of their own. My father used to have great expressions, you know, and my favorite was, did you ever see a mob rush across town to do a good deed? And another one was, if everybody agrees on it, be assured it's wrong.
Your father sounds like a very wise man.
My father believed there was nothing more odious than mass approval. To fear it, to flee it at every opportunity.
Oh, my.
But more seriously,
yeah,
the book does deal ultimately with the preservation of the earth, and Albert, our man who owns the ranch, the retired English professor, has made a lot of people very angry because of his environmental views. And Albert's a radical. During hunting season, he hauls logs across roads that give access to the national forest to keep the hunters out.
Yeah, not too
popular.
There was
a fellow hereabouts who used to do that. He was a famous aviator.
James Lee Burke joins us. His new novel, a Dave Robichaux novel, is Light of the World. We've had a number of these conversations over the years, Jim, and I don't think I've asked you in any recent interviews. You just mentioned your dad. I don't think I've asked you much about how you came up and decided that you wanted to be a writer. How did that happen?
Well, my father always wanted to be a writer. He wrote very good prose and had wanted to be a newspaper man, but he went to work on the pipeline in 1925, and the Depression came along 4 years later, and at that time, if you had a job, you didn't leave it. So he worked in the oil and natural gas industry all his life and died on the job in 1955. And I suspect whatever talent I have, I inherit from him. But I've never wanted to be anything else. I've never had any interest in doing anything else.
But along the way, you've done a lot of other things, haven't you?
Yeah. Lots of things. My wife and I have been married 53 years, and we can always say, in all candor, we lived and worked everywhere, from California to the East Coast and every place in between, and did every kind of dirty job there is. We did it.
Hey, and your daughter, Alifair, has become quite a well-known writer in her own right. She also writes a lot of crime fiction, and she also seems to put out books in the summer.
Yeah.
And she's a former prosecutor. She teaches law at Hofstra. And I heard that you have another child who also became a prosecutor. What's up with that?
Well, we have four children. They've all done quite well. Yes, Al Fair was a prosecutor for the Portland DA's office. She went to Reed before she went to Stanford, then returned to Portland as a ADA. And she also she clerked for Judge Fletcher on the Ninth Circuit. Mm. And it had quite a career as an attorney. She's really good. She edited Bill Clinton.
Really?
For the Stanford Law Review. In fact, he called her up and congratulated on one of her books. Jim Jr. Was a prosecutor 12 years with the U.S. Department of Justice. And Jimmy had one of the highest successful prosecution rates in the country. He's really good at what he does. And he's a corporate lawyer now in Phoenix. We have a daughter, Andre, who's a psychologist, educational psychologist. And my daughter, Pamela, was a TV ad producer and now handles all my business affairs. She does a lot of media stuff for me.
I know she does a lot of Facebook posts for you,
oh,
Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see those.
Yeah, she's real good. She's really good at what she does. She's just a very good media person, but she has a degree in history.
Did she set up that joint interview that you and Al Fair did recently?
Yeah, she did. She does all that. She's a wonder at solving things. Paula is just the kind of person that can fix anything.
It's quite a group that comes out to Montana for this vacation in light of the world. And we haven't really talked very much about Cleet, just mentioned him in passing. Cleet is such an important part of these stories. Tell our listeners about him.
Well, he's a big Irish fellow from the Irish Channel in New Orleans and a contemporary of Dave. He was a Marine in Vietnam. He did two tours there and got shot up pretty bad. But he's the other side of Dave Robichaud's personality. And one man is not complete without the other. One is Don Quixote, the other is Sancho Panza. And Cleet Purcell is the merry prankster. He's the trickster out of traditional folklore. He's a wonderful guy, and his greatest enemy is himself. You know, he was treated very badly by his father growing up in the Irish Channel, and there's a quiet rage inside of Cleet, and he never manifests his feelings. That Dave knows that something is about to happen when he sees the crow wrinkles around Cleet's eyes flatten, and it means it's something terrible. I think it's like, how does Dave put it? A junkyard falling down a staircase, or a steel wrecking ball with spikes on it swinging through a crystal shop. But it's going to be of catastrophic proportions. Uh-huh. In one book, my favorite Cleet episode was when he hijacks an earth grader and drives it through the wall of a mafia owner, mafiosa Don's house out by Lake Pontchartrain and destroys the guy's house. He drives it through one wall, packs it up and down through the dining room and kitchen, grinds up the floors. He even piles up all of the terrace garden and the tile work and the flagstones and pushes it into the swimming pool. The place looks like a Scud missile hit it.
You gotta love him.
But it's just an ordinary luck day in the life of Cleet Purcell.
Yeah. Cleet. Cleet is one of a kind, no question.
Yeah.
And in this book, Light of the World, we have Dave and Cleet supposedly on vacation. They just want to go fishing. They have their daughters with them, and both of their daughters, we heard about Allifair having this arrow almost hit her. Gretchen also has an event that occurs that is very threatening and very frightening to her. So we have these two dads who are suddenly really angry and really upset, and they want to do something about what's threatening their daughters. And they don't really think that the local police are very interested in helping them out. So, of course, we know what's going to happen next. These guys are going to decide they're going to do a little law enforcement out of their jurisdiction themselves.
Well, that's what happens. And, of course, there's a theme that runs through the books, and it has to do with the reality, I think, of law enforcement, the judicial system in this country, or our culture. I'm not a sociologist, but or a legal analyst, but I think anyone listening to this interview who has been a victim of violent crime knows the following to be an absolute, inalterable truth. By and large, you're on your own. And the treatment of crime and prosecution, apprehension on television has nothing at all to do with Riley. Absolutely nothing. Dave puts it more simply, Dave Robichaud. He says, survivors of violent assaults tend to become NRA members.
Hmm.
And that's the truth of the matter. I don't know what the percentage of successfully prosecuted crimes is in the United States. The number 4 comes to mind, 4%, if that, are actually successfully prosecuted. And it's just the way it is. And the fellow who killed people in Wichita, Kansas, did it for 20 years. Hmm. 20 years it went on. It's just unbelievable. And the crimes were just they were of such gravity, they were so cruel in nature, that no reporter who covered the story, no photographer, no forensic expert or pathologist would ever discuss the details.
Huh. Well, Jim, it's always a pleasure having you on the program.
Okay, well, same here, Vic. I hope I didn't talk your arm off again. I said I wasn't.
You're great, Jim. My guest has been James Lee Burke. His new novel is Light of the World. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Tune in next week when we'll be talking to a former Daytonian who has just published a collection of poetry. Next week, Jeff Epton visits the Book Nook. His new book is Wild Once and Captured. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.